Everybody rolls with their fingers crossed. Everybody knows the war is over. Everybody knows the good guys lost. Everybody knows that the fight was fixed. The poor stay poor and the rich get rich. That's how it
That's a little bit of Everybody Knows, and that's, of course, by Leonard Cohen, and we use it as the introduction to Activist Radio, where we offer a little, well, a little history I don't think you learned in high school. We have a couple news stories you haven't read in the New York Times. I check that before I do every program to make sure they haven't covered it yet. And we have a couple songs often to help you join the resistance. Activist Radio is broadcast from the Progressive Radio Network, as well as from WVKR, Vassar College, here in Poughkeepsie, New York. You can listen to us a bunch of different ways. You can go to classwars.org and listen to our last 10 programs, or you can just look us up as a podcast, Activist Radio, and subscribe that way. Our guest today at 5:30 is going to be Susan Smith. She's a former talk show host for Ferguson to Palestine, and that was on a VKR. A great program went for about a year on 91.3 FM right here in Poughkeepsie. She's a local community activist. She's a member of the Community of Living Traditions. That's a multi-faith residential community of Muslim, Jews, and Christians at the Stony Point Center. And she's going to talk about the importance of this amazing document called the International Sanctuary Declaration. So that brings me to the views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of the station, its board of trustees, its constituents, really just nobody except us, Fred and
Rafael.
Hey, welcome. Hey. Welcome back. We're both coming back from quite a ways. So welcome. Nice to have you back. So we're bringing you up to date on America's hidden class wars.
Everybody knows. Everybody knows that it's now. One day our whispers will be louder than your screams. One day our whispers will be louder than your screams. One day our whispers will be louder than your screams. The people's day will come. Emma Goldman, I sang this song for you. Big Bill Haywood and Mother Jones too. Psycho and Vanzetti, they took your lives. But we can organize.
The People's Day by Otis Gibbs. This is your introduction to the first part of our show today, History You Did Not Learn in High School. This is a part of Activist Radio where we remember the history of social struggle that is so often left out of our corporate media.
Okay, we're going to go all the way back to June 13th, 1967. Thurgood Marshall was nominated for Justice of the Supreme Court on that day by President Lyndon Johnson. Marshall was then a Solicitor General of the United States and had been the most important attorney and the lead attorney in the Brown versus Board of Education case that ended legal segregation in the schools. It didn't really stop the segregation, but it ended the legal segregation. He would be America's first African American on the court. Well, he was a complicated figure, Thurgood Marshall. The Brown versus Board of Education, did not really end all segregation because nobody followed it. And the federal government wasn't willing to commit any resources. The local governments, of course, in the deep south, did not want to follow it at all. So it didn't really make a great deal of difference. It was on the books, but black children were not really allowed to enter into segregated schools. That would finally change when blacks and whites, well, put their bodies on the line and ultimately forced the government to intervene. And that would happen, you know, a good deal after the Brown versus Board of Education. Well, Marshall believed in the law, and I think other black leaders during the time, Martin Luther King, Malcolm X, believed in political action. And it's not really the same thing. There was a group of black leaders who believed that if you could just get the law to outline, to demand black rights, it would happen. But these late leaders that came after Marshall demanded it by going out on the street and facing all the dangers, including being assassinated. One of the really questionable things that Marshall did is worked pretty closely with J. Edgar Hoover. And J. Edgar Hoover, of course, maybe to remind you, was dedicated to stopping the emergence of what he called a black messiah, a leader who would ultimately challenge the U.S. status quo on both racism and imperialism. And so to have Marshall, you know, having secret meetings with J. Edgar Hoover really calls into question what he was doing or how helpful maybe he was. Was he reporting on Malcolm X and Martin Luther King? The FBI was especially concerned about Malcolm X, Martin Luther King, and also Huey Newton and Fred Hampton. And in the coming years, all four would be assassinated, leaving a lot of doubt about the actual role the FBI played in destroying the black movements of the 1960s. Still, we don't really know. The more evidence that comes along, the more the FBI looks guilty of doing, maybe not stopping these assassinations, and certainly with Fred Hampton, they were very much involved in that assassination. So, in a way, Marshall considered himself, well, part of the white power structure in America. And he was an avid anti-communist. He saw that the black, he thought to himself the black movement could become a communist movement. So maybe he was easy to manipulate, as maybe Barack Obama was easy to manipulate. And the question still remains, did their public service actually help black people? I think only a more honest look at the nation's Jim Crow history can provide all those answers. So I had known about Thurgood Marshall's talking with J. Edgar Hoover, but there's quite a lot of information on it. How can you be working secretly with a person who wants to crush the black liberation movement in America and still be considered, you know, a friend to black people?
I think it depends how structural you want to get in terms of viewing who is going to, what needs to happen. If it's just, you know, different colored faces in power, that's not really structural.
Yeah, it's not. I mean, you think it's got to be, but time and time again, it's not that at all. It really achieves very little. As a matter of fact, some people say it's a cover for, you know, things happening in government that aren't acceptable, elect, you know, a black leader. So, yeah, it's, and then, you know, we're two white people. Should we be criticizing Thurgood Marshall? I mean,
well, you know, it was interesting when you were talking about the calendar of events and you mentioned Engine's event that's looking at, you know, disciplinary rates in the public schools between black students and white students. And I was thinking to myself, it's much more than just kids and disciplining. And And people say it's racist and they just leave it at that. But if you think about it, it's also interconnected. So a lot of these children will come from homes which probably have, you know, some socioeconomic issues because their parents don't have educations, because they don't have jobs, whatever, you know, and that's all going back to being, you know, discriminated against in the workforce. So it all compounds. And it's deeply, deeply rooted in the history, as we all know. So to think that you can just switch out a face at the top with a black person and suddenly that's going to fix all of these historical, deeply rooted issues.
Yeah, it's so interesting. I went to Prague, maybe I mentioned this before actually, and went to the oldest synagogue. I think it's the oldest synagogue in Europe, and was reading about the history of the Jews in Prague. It's not a pretty history, you know, 1,000 years of oppression. And they couldn't go to school. They could rarely leave their areas. They didn't even have enough place to bury their dead, so they buried them 3, 4, and 5 deep in the graveyard, a very strange-looking graveyard, too. But once the laws were passed allowing them to get an education, they put that Jews put that behind them, and you know, by 1920 they were fully integrated within society. But the laws had to be changed, but for 1,000 years they were known as the thieves, the violent people in the society, the people that the police always arrested. You know, that can happen to any people under systematic racism and oppression.
And I think also what was happening there, it wasn't just the laws changed. It was cultural just foment and change. And a lot of that was from people coming back from the First World War.
Yeah, that's...
So, you know, the whole society was in flux.
It's such a complicated thing, because a lot of people blame the jealousy on the part of the non-Jewish populations for their avid acceptance of Nazism and the anti-Semitism that came with it. Some people say, well, that was the jealousy and the anger for Jews who had been able to at long last free themselves from their little community and go to colleges and make more of themselves. It left a jealousy, and maybe we're seeing the backlash of the 1960s civil rights movement and this, you know, white Christian racism that's taking over our land. It's all, racism is such a complex issue, and we reduce it to, you know, simplicities, but it's very complex.
It's almost always rooted in some economic issues.
Yeah, oh, it definitely is. Yeah. So politics is who gets the most. So that's, you know, not exactly the quote about politics is the distribution of wealth. I think that's the quote. Politics is the distribution of wealth. Well, we're going to go to a lighter note here. We're going to go, because it's a deep conversation. This is J. Edgar Hoover. Hail to the Chief is the song, and it's from a musical. So here we go.
Gone are the days when life was simple, when the world was either black or white. There were no shades of gray. We kept the commies at bay, and we had J. Edgar Hoover to show us the way. Take me back to the days of J. Edgar Hoover, a man who ruled with iron fist. The FBI had your name. They knew who to blame. If you leaned to the left, you went right on his list. Right on his list. Take me back to the days of J. Edgar Hoover. Though he was scorned and sometimes mocked, he played by only his rules and suffered no fools. Okay, once in a while he might go off half-cocked. Go off half-cocked. Oh, to have been a part of that glorious time when your days were devoted to just fighting crime. We could bug all the subversives and nobody'd complain. J. Edgar had a grip on their balls and their brain. Some say he was like Attila the Hun, just because he had secret files and he could blackmail anyone. Was anybody happy? All those rumors you've heard about Mr. Hoover, they're envious of his success. He was a generous soul, a man among men, and I swear that he never wore heels in a dress. Heels in a dress, Clyde Tolson told me so. Oh, to have been a part of those glorious days when J. Edgar get tabs on the Jews, blacks, and gays. If his enemies defied him, he'd start a smear campaign. When Hoover vacuumed you, you went right down the drain. Some say he was mean and vicious and crass, 'cause he'd take all your constitutional rights and kick them in the ass. And what's wrong with that? Take me back to the days of J. Edgar Hoover. Stuff your PC platitudes. J. Edgar got the job done and squashed anyone who would get in his way with their bad attitudes. Bad attitudes like Petridge, I hate him. I don't want to go back to Dixie or Swanee. That's never been part of my plan. So take me back to the days of J. Edgar Hoover and I'll be a happy man.
They lied, they lied, they took us for a ride. Tried burying the truth where it very nearly died. They lied, but no matter what they tried, hide. Sing and shout, the truth wins out. Everybody knows they lied.
They Lied by J. Mankita. This is the lead into the next part of our show, fantasylandmedia.org. Here we take a look at the failings of our corporate-controlled media, where all the news is fashioned by the people in charge, the corporations and your government. And Fred and I are still having a bit of a chuckle about that great little tune from the musical called J. Edgar Hoover.
And that was a questionable musical and a questionable song, but it really does say a lot.
I don't think it's saying anything that people don't know already.
Well, he's got so many secrets. He had a special room in the bottom of the FBI building where he showed pornographic movies to people who he thought that would like that. But of course, he was a cross dresser and was gay too. So here the idea of this person showing heterosexual pornography to heterosexual men, and you know, later that night he would cross dress and go out to parties. I mean, it's just an amazing history that man.
I mean, he was probably trying to compromise people by showing them.
Oh, probably so.
Yeah.
Probably so.
Yeah.
And he was the one in the audience when Eugene Debs gave a speech against the First World War. He was the young man taking notes, and he testified against Eugene Debs, and they put him in jail for several years for speaking out against World War One. So he's part of American history. He is American history, as a matter of fact, for all those years. But
and there we go. That's a bit of a loop. Espionage Act.
That's true, yeah.
So what's changed in 100 years?
Because it actually
leads into our next story, which is from Waking Times.
Yeah, go ahead.
And this is a letter that Julian Assange wrote to one of his supporters from Belmarsh Prison in the UK, where he's been held. It's a year sentence. I think he's been there for, what, like about 6 weeks, maybe 2 months.
Yeah.
So this is quoting from the letter that Julian Assange sent. He says, "I've been isolated from all ability to prepare to defend myself. No laptop, no internet ever, no computer, no library so far. But even if I get access, it will be just for half an hour with everyone else once a week. Just two visits a month, and it takes weeks to get someone on the call list. And a catch-22 is getting their details to be security screened. Then all calls except lawyers are recorded, and calls are a maximum of 10 minutes, and in a limited 30-minute window each day in which all the prisoners compete for the phone. And then in terms of credit, just a few pounds a week and no one can call in. So that's what he's experiencing. And then he writes on, the other side, a superpower that has been preparing for 9 years with hundreds of people and untold millions spent on the case. I am defenseless and I am counting on you and others of good character to save my life. I am unbroken, albeit literally surrounded by murderers, but the days when I could read and speak and organize to defend myself, my ideals and my people are over until I am free. Everyone else must take my place. So, yeah, the silencing of Julian Assange shows that Western democracies are entering a new era of censorship and conformity. Assange's words, however, can get out to Americans through independent media, which is your best source for news that is free from corporate influence.
Yeah, I looked all over for this statement, and where'd I finally get it? From something called Waking Times. This was not covered on the right or the left or the mainstream media. The lockdown on Assange is so complete in our media that you'll never hear his words.
And you know, the other thing that happened when he was taken out of the embassy is that the UK police and I think possibly other entities went into the Ecuadorian embassy and took all of his personal effects. Not only can he not defend himself when he's in prison, but all of his personal effects have been taken and scoured over. And, so the other side has everything that they could possibly want in terms of what he's been doing, thinking, saying.
How can the Western countries, the U.S. and Europe, too, maintain that they have some sort of freedom of the press when you treat a person who reports very, very important stories to the world, stories that were damaging to the U.S., the most damaging I've played on the radio before. It was a tape of people, U.S. Soldiers in helicopters shooting at civilians and killing a good number of them. It was a massacre from the air. And that is what Julian Assange, that's probably why the Western countries, especially the U.S., hate him, because he exposed the war crimes of the empire.
And that's, I think, what he's being charged with. It's not anything to do with the emails from 2016. As far as I know, it's the files. And they're saying that because he encouraged Chelsea Manning, he's complicit in what she did. But, it's I was just going to say one thing about, so-called left-wing media like The Guardian. I feel that it's used, The Guardian, as a way to make people think they're getting the full story when they're looking for alternative news. And I think that's really dangerous because, I've been really amazed. The Guardian has not reported at all on the fact that the U.S., federal police invaded the Venezuelan embassy. They did not report that story at all. That's such a critical piece of history, and they didn't do anything.
Yeah, I think The Guardian will surprise you often because it will report a story that the New York Times doesn't. The New York Times is supposed to be sort of the liberal establishment wing of the media. But lots of times The Guardian, especially in stories about race relations, stories about U.S. overseas troop movements, things like that, The Guardian will report it. But when you look at The Guardian reporting on lots of other things, including Honduras, when the country was overthrown, the democratically elected president was overthrown 2 years ago, The Guardian, was nowhere to be seen. It just went along with the empire. So, there's no place to really find the truth out, and certainly it's not RT. Do you look at RT often?
Well, I do actually, because I'm aware that it is Russian propaganda. But because they are the enemy on the other side, they're telling you what they're seeing. And as long as it's factual, it's very interesting. I just, you know, take what they're saying, these facts, which they're not that are not being reported in the Western media, but RT will report them.
Yeah, I think for Iran, it's really important to get what RT is saying. And Chris Hedges, has a weekly program that's wonderful on RT, and Chris Hedges has won a bunch of Pulitzer Prizes, worked for the New York Times for 15 or so years. One of the best journalist reporters in the world, and he works for RT. So if you want to listen to Chris Hedges interviewing people and giving his commentary, go to RT. So anyway, we'll go to the second story here. I'll throw one other thing in. WikiLeaks.shop, www.wikileaks.shop. You can own a briefcase just like I do.
Well, that's good to know.
That has WikiLeaks right on the front of it. So.
And that's pretty cool logo to walk around with.
I know. I need a new one. It's getting old. But.
And does that go to Julian Assange's defense fund?
Yes, it does.
That's fantastic.
Yeah. Next story is from Popular Resistance. At the end of May, the Trump administration announced new unilateral economic coercive measures against Venezuela, this time sanctioning people involved in food distribution program called CLAP, C-L-A-P. The program delivers basic foods and supplies to over 7 million people, families, every month for about 40 cents each. It has helped sustain people who are struggling because of the hyperinflation, which makes basic goods unaffordable. But the Venezuelan people remain undeterred. They will now use the civilian militia composed of almost 2.2 million men and women to distribute food and goods to those who are vulnerable. The CLAP program is one example of the way Venezuelan government works to meet the basic needs of its people. Another is the Great Housing Project and GMVV. The UN recognized Venezuela as a top country for its work to provide housing as a human right. Venezuela has built over 2.6 million special housing units. Well, that sounds again like you're just being crazy on the air to say anything good about Venezuela. Our media is so far from ever giving you that point of view about Venezuela. I think Venezuela helps you as a listener understand the limits of our free press in the good old USA. Going against the Pentagon and its military objectives is always verboten. The empire's interests always come first.
And, you know, I thought to myself, how can corporate media possibly spin this? Because, you know, this is feeding very desperate people. And so I went to the Wall Street Journal. It has a long, long article on this, which is not behind their paywall.
Oh, no kidding.
And
huh.
The way they're trying to spin it is to say that this whole program is about laundering money. And it's for drugs.
Like, isn't that something?
So the whole thing is being presented as some really nefarious program where these oligarchs that are aligned with Maduro, they use it as a way to, you know, extort money from the government. And
amazing.
So, you know, and I just want to say one thing, that apparently, according to the Center for Economic and Policy Research, As many as 40,000 people may have died because of U.S. sanctions in Venezuela, and up to about $130 billion in damage just in the last 3 years to their economy.
And
so this is huge.
Compare that to Iraq, certainly, where the 10-year economic embargo studies show that up to 1 million people died during that time because of the squeeze we put on Iraq before we invaded. So this is the way the empire works. Squeeze them first, destroy their economy, and then if you can do it, you know, invade them. And I think I'm worried that both Iran and Venezuela are on the hit list for the empire.
Yeah, and you know, if people want to really just check if an article is balanced, do a quick word check to see if the word sanctions comes up in it when, if it's a Venezuelan article, because that one, I read one in the New Yorker the other day talking about, you know, how bad Maduro is, and not once did they mention the word sanctions in the entire article.
That's amazing. The New Yorker, right? Progressive, quote unquote.
Do we have time for a third
one? Sure, we'll do this third one.
Okay, I'll try not to speak too much. So this is from another real favorite website of ours, Common Dreams, and it's closer to home. So this is about Big Pharma. Citing fears of Americans getting screwed, progressive Democrats call out Pelosi for crafting a pharma-friendly drug pricing bill in secret. Amid concerns that the House Democratic leadership is crafting a drug pricing bill that is far too friendly to the pharmaceutical industry, progressives in Congress this week publicly called on Nancy Pelosi for writing legislation in secret and ignoring those who favor a more aggressive approach to lowering out-of-control prescription drug costs. Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez from New York was among the progressive Democrats who spoke out on Wednesday, telling reporters that the House Democratic leadership has left most members completely in the dark on the details of this prescription drug bill. Hmm. And they're also ignoring another bill which has been put forward, which let me get the name for that if people are interested. It's Representative Lloyd Doggett from Texas. And what's interesting about this is it's a bipartisan bill with 125 House co-sponsors, and the leadership is completely ignoring it. It would Medicaid would be permitted to negotiate drug prices.
Oh, really? Huh. That's interesting.
It's interesting it's bipartisan, too.
Yeah, more dangerous to the Democratic establishment because it might go through, you know. But, you've been able to get by my purple prose.
About the New York. Well, here's a surprise. The New York Times does not report this at all.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah.
So it's Nancy Pelosi. If she, wouldn't it be amazing if the resurgent Democrats, the progressives, were actually able to change the party? I've never really allowed myself to think that that was possible, but you know, the closest they've come so far.
Well, I'm going to give a shout out to one of the Democrat presidential nominees, candidates.
Joe Biden.
Pedo Joe? No, not Pedo Joe. Tulsi Gabbard.
Ah.
Because I think she's progressive, but because she's a major in the Army who was doing a tour of duty twice in Iraq, and, you know, she has very strong military credentials, I feel that she could be a crossover candidate. I think there are people on the right, libertarian right, who would actually find her, what she says, quite interesting.
Yeah, that is interesting. Okay, we're going to go to our interview with Susan Smith, talking about the importance of international, what she calls the International Sanctuary Declaration. I'll put a link to that right on Class Wars, and let's go talk to Susan Smith.
All right, Susan Smith, thank you so much for being on Activist Radio today. I'm eager to talk about the International Sanctuary Principles, so thank you so much for taking the time to be on Activist Radio.
Thank you so much, Fred, and thank you for raising this issue for folks to learn about.
I was wondering whether smaller groups like the Mideast Crisis can sign this. Are you looking for smaller groups, or is there a criteria for being able to sign this letter? We'll talk about the letter, but I was just interested in our listeners out there, can they sign this letter individually, or can their human rights groups sign this letter?
You know, all groups who do migrant response work are welcome and encouraged to sign on, but I would extend that as well to our organizations such as Middle East Crisis Response, which look at the root causes that create the migration crisis.
I see. Okay, great. All right. And I have the principle statement before me, and I'm wondering how do these principles in this statement differ from what's being done now by the U.S. and maybe also by the European governments? Is our own government violating these principles? And how about European governments? How do they stand compared to your call for international sanctuary?
Well, If we look at the global position, if you will, and there was the conference on migration in Marrakesh last year.
Mm-hmm.
It was a day late and a dollar short. And what it did essentially was lift up the issue that we have a growing and getting worse and worse refugee crisis, migration crisis, forced displacement crisis, both within countries and beyond borders. But it didn't look at root causes. And so it sort of focused more. Yeah. And when you have the five permanent members of the Security Council creating much of the mayhem that causes these root causes, you can see how the global organization has got to steer away from calling them out and putting them on the spot. And so it focused, the Global Compact on Migration focuses more on the responsibility of host countries to care for the refugees, migrants, and also for the migrants themselves to observe and respect the culture of the countries that they are visiting.
I see.
Yeah, but without looking at, for example, proxy wars or violence, neocolonialism, poverty caused by, for example, the government of France and the French African euro leading to the basic neo-enslavement of French peoples and Francophone nations who cannot have a vibrant, independent economy because France is sucking the life out of their economy.
Yeah.
So when we look at the EU, on the European border, the Mediterranean, for example, has in the situation with migrants traveling primarily through North Africa and also across Turkey through Greece, successively since 2015 when we had the Syrian refugee crisis and also at a time when ISIS, or the Islamic State, was taking over huge swaths of Iraq and Syria, when we had this huge swelling of migration, at that time there were dozens of migrant rescue boats in the Mediterranean. In the Eastern Mediterranean and in the Central Mediterranean. And now, for example, in the Central Mediterranean, there's just one or two migrant boats, rescue boats left, one of which is Sea Watch. Doctors Without Borders and a whole bunch of other boats have successively been brought out of commission for a number of reasons.
There's so few boats now, and this is an interesting discussion because it's just never talked about in the U.S. media, you know, who's to blame for the refugee crisis. I mean, they never discuss that, and it's so blatant because all these, for example, we overthrew the elected government of Honduras and installed a military dictatorship, and of course now the Hondurans are fleeing the violence in their country that we created. Do the principles talk about who's to blame for the crisis? I know it's a short statement of principle, but do you call these countries like the U.S. and France, do you demand that they share responsibility for what they've done?
Well, if I could take a step back, Fred, and just read an opening statement from the International Sanctuary Principle.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the statement and call for endorsers sets forth five principles of sanctuary that can be used to guide grassroots and governmental response to the global escalation of displacement. And it's in conformity and solidarity with the UN Convention relating to the Status of Refugees of 1951, which is a multilateral treaty. It defines who is a refugee and also sets out rights and, of individuals and responsibilities of nations that grant asylum. Mm-hmm. So when those nations fail to abide by this international covenant, the Convention on the Status of Refugees, then we, people of faith and conscience and moral values, we need to rise up and work together to call upon our governments to receive migrants with compassion. And the Sanctuary Principle Statement has five principles. The first is compassionate response. And when we think of children, for example, on, mm-hmm. on the border, you know, a lot of folks started to pay attention to the migration issues on the border when we saw that children were being detained.
Mm-hmm.
But in fact, this has been happening for many, many years, and it's not just about children.
So you see, essentially, a citizen's an obligation of citizens to fill in where their governments have failed. Is it a call for citizens, call for a compassionate response from citizens to do the right thing by their refugee populations, right? Would this include, for example, sanctuary in churches, putting water
Absolutely.
Out on the, putting water out on the desert and food and Right. Huh.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. So it is a call for civil initiative as our right and responsibility for people to act to support our neighbors when the government wants to do so. And this is actually the fifth principle of the Declaration. And we mentioned Sea Watch as one organization as our other migrant refugee rescue boats search and rescue. Operations that are being criminalized. Another, as you mentioned on the border, no more deaths. Scott Warren of No More Deaths in Arizona is now facing up to 20 years in prison for simply putting water out in the desert.
Yeah. Now, was he just released? Maybe overnight or something? I should have checked that in the morning, but I think maybe he was very recently. Those charges were dropped, but I could be wrong. We'll take a look at that, and we'll let the audience know if that's true.
Thank you for that update. Actually, No More Deaths, along with the Presbyterian Church, and also Reverend Bob Bashir of the West Park Presbyterian Church in New York City, and the New Sanctuary Coalition, and also some International Fellowship of Reconciliation. Members in Germany and the Canadian Sanctuary Network, Asylum in the Church in Berlin. These are the lead signatories. So now we've got about 50 signatories, and we it's growing, and it's a broad range. So we really want to take advantage of this discussion with you, Fred, to invite organizations to sign on.
Great. We'll put a link right on Activist Radio when this airs, and so people will know how to do this. Who are you educating with this list of sanctuary principles? I assume that countries like France and the United States, they know what they've done to create these refugees. I mean, people that run these countries are smart. They, for example, all the state-supported corn growers, the farmers all throughout the Midwest that are given millions of dollars and ship all their corn to Mexico at reduced prices, driving off the farmers off their land. Somebody must realize the result of doing this and fighting these wars in Central America, you know, the overthrow in Honduras, disruptions in Nicaragua, I mean, American officials must know. So you're not really trying to educate them with this list. Who are you educating by publishing this list and talking about it?
Well, it's really meant to be a tool for grassroots responders. Uniting us, and also so we understand each other's struggles. So, for example,
I see.
So migrants coming across the border with Mexico, they know that they're not, as Trump called them, you know, rapists and drug mm-hmm. dealers. That the vast majority of them are just wonderful folk like everybody else. Mm-hmm. By the same token, most of the refugees coming from the Middle East aren't terrorists. They are simple, wonderful folks like everyone else. So it's a way for us to learn about and understand each other's struggles, and also support each other when people are criminalized. So we just spoke, for example, about Scott Warren, who was and others of No More Deaths facing 20 years. There was a couple of years ago in Greece, a young woman, a Syrian woman, Sarah Mardini. I don't know if you heard about her.
No.
She and her sister were amazing swimmers. And actually, Sarah went on to be an Olympic swimmer for Germany, I believe, where she eventually was given asylum. But at one point, she was arrested by the government of Greece for swimming out to a boat to save people drowning in a dinghy. And she spent time, she was incarcerated for some time. And, you know, it's situations like that where we want to list up folks like Scott Warren and Sarah Mardini as like poster representatives of a larger cause that impacts us, whether in the Hudson Valley, New York City, or wherever. People are being criminalized for trying to do what is just and right, and actually in compliance with international law.
Yeah, my last question, unfortunately, we just have 15 minutes, but last quick question. Aren't many of these principles in the statement, aren't they already in international law? I mean, how do the principles fit with international law? Aren't most of them already written down as part of the way countries should be treating each other?
You know, Fred, we live in, as you are very well aware, in Orwellian times, right? So when we think, for example, of the Millennial Development Goals of 2000 that the United Nations set forth, 8 goals about what we wanted to achieve by 2018 for global prosperity, you know, universal health, universal primary education, all of these things. And then in 2015, the UN upgraded this, as you will, to be 17 sustainable development goals, right?
I see.
Of all the sustainable development goals, not one of them talks about ending war and militarism.
Isn't that something?
And why are things left out of the picture? You know, there's a way of leading the global community down a garden path, you know, handing them a bone, like the Paris Climate Accord, another day late and a dollar short. Yes, it's good, okay, something, but it's not enough. So these principles of the International Sanctuary Statement, compassionate response, due process, you know, fair and timely legal proceedings and representation, family unity, not separating children from families, et cetera, restorative justice, revitalization and healing of our borderlands, not militarization, holistic approaches that address root causes, and then civil initiative that we, the people, the impacted community, the folks on the ground, ultimately it's up to us to step in when governments are mm-hmm. not.
Susan, I want to thank you for being on Activist Radio today and advocating these important responses to governments that are obviously not being humane or even just or even fair when treating citizens applying for asylum. So I want to thank you for your work in getting this message out. And we'll put links to all this on Class Wars. And good luck in your work. And we'll be following your work, Susan. So thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Fred. Thank you for this wonderful program.
Okay, thanks. Bye now.
Bye-bye.
All right, Susan Smith. And when I go home tonight, I'm going to put her that document on, and you can read it. It's just one page, but it outlines how governments should be treating migrants and all people. So it's quite idealistic, but in this time, idealism is in short supply, isn't it?
I mean, yes.
How are you idealistic about the Western world? You know,
I like the way she connects up the bigger structural reason for why these people are so desperate.
She does a nice job in doing that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So yeah, we were talking in the break, recently, about just what you're saying, idealism and outrage. And we're talking about the fact that really outrage is kind of, in many ways, all that we have left in terms of countering and at least in our minds staying independent and acknowledging all these terrible things happening. And then we were talking about how the way the media and also the Democratic Party sort of siphons off that outrage, which should really be targeted at the things that are going on that are so outrageous in this world, and instead targets it at Trump.
Mm.
And so we were saying Trump is like a outrage sink, you know, a way of taking away people's genuine and legitimate anger at things and turning it towards someone who's got like orange hair and makes stupid tweets and, you know, sits in a sunbed too long.
And he understands his role, I believe, more than most people in this country. His role is really to be a television, you know, bad guy for most of the country or for a lot of the country, to stir people up. To try to say as many racist things as he can possibly think of, but he knows that he doesn't need to read anything. He hardly knows anything about the countries he visits. Certainly not about the issues. He's really there as a personality, a television personality, and I think he understands his role better than most because he couldn't be bothered reading anything. He watches the TV. You know, and so because he wants to outrage, his next outrageous claim will come from watching TV at nights. He's not really a leader in a way. He's, maybe a clown or something.
And he knows that no publicity is bad publicity.
Yep.
You know, it's all going to help him.
From Roy Cohen, he learned that. And but sometimes, I mean, the long view. Sometimes a foolish figure like Mussolini ends up bringing on catastrophe. And, you know, another Trump 4 years, you don't really know what's going to be left of what we call the free press. We criticize it often enough, but if it's under the thumb of a Trump-like figure, that would be another big difference. So.
And you know, it's not just Trump, it's his whole administration, because the other day Mike Pompeo was giving a speech to a group of Jewish leaders, and this was definitely not in the New York Times, and one of them recorded what he was saying. And someone had asked him about Jeremy Corbyn, who's the Labour leader, and said to him, would you support Jeremy Corbyn becoming the Prime Minister of the UK? And he said, no, we'll definitely take steps to make sure that doesn't happen.
Oh my goodness.
I mean, I'm kind of paraphrasing him, but it's not taking away from the sense of what he was saying. He was basically saying, we'll make sure that doesn't happen.
Yeah. He makes statements about that, about the press. He makes statements about gathering his tough guys, the motorcycle gang that supports Trump. He talks about violence in the same way that Mussolini well used the brown shirts to get into power. So no, he's definitely I think a fascist, a very dangerous person.
But you see, we're also falling into the same trap here, because instead of now we're all going down this route about we hate Trump and we're all kind of reinforcing ourselves, but we're not talking about why the Democrats don't allow a bigger conversation, for example, and force us to now be speaking about Trump instead of talking about how much of it's bipartisan.
Because maybe fascism comes from a neoliberal Democratic Party that results in a Trump. Maybe that's the way fascism develops. And if we knew more, about the history of fascism, if people even talked about fascism, studying fascism, we would, I think, be a lot more aware of what's happening to our society. But, with that, we're going to sign off until next week. And we got some really good guests coming up. Somebody who's done a lot of work on Venezuela will be one of our guests. So we'll see you next week.
Bye, everyone.
Activist Radio is on the Progressive Radio Network, PRN.FM, every Sunday from 5 to 6 p.m. The show is also broadcast every Thursday from 5 to 6 p.m. on WVKR 91.3 FM at Vassar College. Past shows are on ClassWars.org. Be sure to like Activist Radio on our Facebook page and check out our ClassWars.org blog for commentary on today's interview. We'll be returning next week at this same time to help you become part of the resistance.